without the light.
Good morning. I assume you all have coffee and donuts by now and have refilled cups if you so wish. My goodness, that wasn't worth all that, was it? I'm pleased to welcome this morning a fellow Reformation historian and a friend, Professor James Kittleson. You see before you, those of you who are in my 11 o'clock class, the reason why I wasn't there yesterday, because O'Hare Airport swallowed him up, and he was bumped to a different airline, and we had a big mess, but he's here today. Professor Kittleson got his BA from St. Olaf College in Minnesota, his MA and his PhD from Stanford. He began his teaching career at Iowa for 4 years and then moved on to Ohio State University, where he is now coming up in not too long a time on an even 20 there, having overlapped with Harold Grimm. Some of you know that name from the Reformation era text. He is there as now as professor of Reformation history and also director of graduate studies in the history department. He's the author of numerous articles in such journals as the 16th Century Journal, the Archive for Reformation History, Central European History, Journal of Modern History, the CTQ, and he has had things in our Concordia Journal as well. The author of 3 books on Wolfgang Capito, a humanist and reformer, on universities in transition with their rebirth, reform, and resilience, and then most recently, an English biography, Luther the Reformer, done by Augsburg Press, that I've held up in class before, and to my mind is really a very fine book and well worth your while. He is a frequent speaker on programs at professional societies, the American Historical Association, Church History, at the Medieval Studies Conference in Kalamazoo. He has been a seminar leader for the International Congress on Luther Research 2 years ago in Oslo on Luther and Education, and will be again when the conference comes back after a long hiatus back to the U.S. to Luther Northwestern in a couple of years. Professor Kittleson, again, my opinion, is on the side of the angels when it comes to Reformation history, having done battle with all sorts of misinterpretations of Luther, with the deconstructionists who don't care much about what Luther's text says anymore. He is sometimes a thorn in people's flesh. He has an article in the Lutheran Quarterly, Ecumenism and Condemnation of Luther and Early Lutheranism, the most recent LQ, in which he talks about Christ and a confessional position not being somewhere on a spectrum when it comes to ecumenical gatherings, but actually at the center point of a circle. Which changes your perspective on discussions greatly, and that has rankled some people too. In a day and age when universities stand for anything, or maybe more appropriately, not much of anything, and you find Reformation history being taught when you look around the field by Marxists and by cynics and by skeptics, it is nice to find a man who not only teaches about Luther and the Reformation, but a man who also takes the message and takes the texts quite seriously. He comes this morning and speaks to us on a topic of life in the spirit. Professor Kittleson.
If only my students at Ohio State responded so marvelously, and if only my chair and the other members of my department thought so well of me. But the fact of the matter is I was explaining to Bob and Lane last night at dinner at the Ohio State University, we programmatically believe in nothing. That is to say, individuals believe in all sorts of crazy things, but programmatically as a university, we believe in nothing. I think that probably gives us the claim to being the most secular university in the entire world. My pleasure at being here is cautioned only by a conversation that Bob and I had when I announced to him my topic. When I said I wanted to talk about life in the Spirit, he said, "Oh, you won't find anybody to shoot at here on that subject." Well, I hope that's wrong. I hope there is somebody that I can shoot at a little bit, even if they're not present. With a little luck, perhaps I will manage to accomplish my chief goal in life for these kinds of presentations, and that is to say, offend everyone. In the discussion that might follow, I might even learn something. why, I think we deserve an answer to this, all of us, and this, by the way, is my interim answer. Why should we spend time talking about the subject, life in the spirit? And I think the first answer to that question is because everyone else is talking about it. Popular culture in the United States is very keen on spiritual matters. And this comes all the way from the proliferation of 12-step programs, which have moved from alcoholism all the way up to what is defined as codependency in about 35 or 50 different ways. Most of us who rather like having our spouses care for us are defined thereby as codependent. And the answer to all of these problems, these pains and difficulties with which we live in our lives, is said to be a spiritual answer. I refer also to the new Gnosticism, that is to say, New Age spirituality. I still happen to think that the chief guru, Ms. McLean, has a great pair of legs. I'm old enough to remember her from Damn Yankee. But frankly, her spirituality is pure Gnosticism. And I got a letter from a former student about, 3 weeks ago. She's a Methodist, and in their Methodist newspaper, they had a little place where readers can write in whatever their opinion is about things, rightly called, by the way, Here I Stand. I think that's kind of cute. In which a person was objecting to a recent book published by Harper and Row, which of course is no mean slouch as a press, entitled Sophia, Mainlining Feminist Theology, which says, among other things, that Jesus was the product of a union between God and Sophia, and Sophia was really the boss in the whole thing. This is a feminine God. And of course, right on its heels comes in a certain fertility religion, all of which does not surprise me in the least, but I just wish when somebody was coming up with a heresy, they could do something new. Popular culture has seized on to spirituality as a solution for the ills of humanity. I would simply add that spirituality is a hot topic, at least on my side of the fence in the Lutheran Church. The Lutheran, our biweekly or sometimes weekly magazine, which used to be called in the old ALC the Lutheran Standard, which at least allowed us to call it the Lutheran Substandard, is in the midst of running an 11-part series, which is one of the longest series they've ever run. In the 11-part series is entitled The Way of the Spirit. And believe me, if you want to know what they're thinking out there in the parishes, make sure you read such things as the Lutheran, because those people have a finger, nay, a thumb on the pulse of what's going on out in the parishes and what will make people read their magazine. Columbus, Ohio, in addition, is a somehow has the honor of being the annual host of something that's called the Conference on the Holy Spirit, in which I suppose they gum the poor being to death. I don't know, because although I have been invited many times, I have steadfastly come down with a cold at the appropriate moment. But I have to tell you, report to you something that is perhaps a little more grave that I was telling Bob and Elaine about last night, and that is that I ended at the beginning of October a 5-week series teaching adult education between services at a large church, Lutheran Church in Columbus, and I gave a version, an early sort of trial run of this presentation to them on the penultimate day I was with them. And the week before, I asked them to think about what they were doing when they were being spiritual. Now, you know, let's get away. We'll get rid of the smoke and the mirrors and all this stuff. And let's understand behaviorally what is going on when you're being spiritual. And I began that penultimate presentation with a blackboard behind me, writing down everything they told me they were doing when they were being spiritual. Now, please bear in mind that this presentation occurred between services, and so many of the people in the audience had been to the first service. They had also received the Lord's Supper during that previous service. And when the sort of the list of things that they were doing when they were spiritual kind of ran out, and the audience became a little dry, I said, "Are you sure there's nothing else? And does anybody have anything else to say?" And really leaned on them a little bit to see if I couldn't drag something else out. And it all stopped. And I pointed out that no one had said they were being spiritual when they were at worship service, hearing the word, or receiving the sacrament. No one. Everybody else is talking about it, and all kinds of strange things are happening. There's also a good biblical basis for talking about the Spirit. We are told, after all, that unless you be born of the Spirit, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. But at the same time, the spirits need to be tested, as Paul had it, to see if they be from God. And that's yet another good reason for addressing the topic. That testing process is something we can relate to directly and immediately, because there's good evidence that this is wise counsel. We can think of the recent embarrassments that occurred in the churches of the Assembly of God. I personally am of the opinion that Tammy Baker should now be indicted on charges of receiving stolen goods. But at least her husband is sweating it out in a prison up in Rochester, Minnesota. We have, of course, the dark, even blacker example of Jonestown. We have faith healers of all kinds. We have sects of all kinds. And as I said, that most recent version of Gnosticism, the New Age spirituality. I think there's also no question but that unless they are very lucky, people get hurt, and hurt very deeply, by many of these kinds of spirituality. And I think that's happening, I know that's happening in congregations in the ELCA, and I suspect it's happening in congregations inside the LCMS too. Because this spirituality is a sort of form of escapism from the reality of life. And then when reality comes crashing in, as it has its nasty way of doing so for most of us in most of our lives, the response is a sort of blank, stark, gut-wrenching horror. What really sort of amazes me is, as this Baker affair continues to play itself out, is to observe that many of Jim and Tammy Baker's followers, and I do say they were Jim and Tammy Baker's followers and nobody else's, are exhibiting a curious form of behavior which many of us recognize as the grief syndrome. And there are, if you read the newspapers, still people engaged in the first phase of the grief syndrome, namely denial. Denying that it ever happened, denying that something good wasn't going on there, denying, 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 when it's all obvious to us, and in particular to the Internal Revenue Service, with whom only a fool messes, that something wrong was going on there. A horrible reality. And I think that something has to be wrong in many of these circles, and I realize I'm stepping outside the bounds of spirituality narrowly defined, but something has to be wrong when someone like Jerry Falwell can describe James Dobson as, quote, a real comer in the evangelism business. The crassness of that deserves to be spread around. Now, many of us have known about this dark side to much of contemporary talk about life and the spirit, and we've known it for a long time. We also, most of us, know, I think, and here I feel among friends, that it truthfully amounts to a theology of glory, to use Luther's terminology, that results for some in a feel-good spirituality or feel-good religion. And most of us recognize that the chief problem is that the same standards by which we judge worldly success are at play here in determining the health of one's spiritual life, when the standards should be just the opposite. The idea at root is that if it feels good or makes you feel good, it must be good. But of course, this idea is not just false, but diabolical. Lots of things that reportedly feel good or lead to good feelings, alcohol, drugs, illicit sex, can kill us. Ernest Hemingway is reported to have said, if you feel good about it after you've done it, then there was nothing wrong with it. And of course, most of us know how he ended his life. Now, all of this, I have the sense that you're with me on, but now I want to add something that you may not find terribly comforting. At least I don't find it terribly comforting. And that is this. I think there's a real sense in which the church today finds itself once again in much the same situation it was in the late Middle Ages. That is to say, there is a demand for spiritual goodies, an almost insatiable demand for them. To turn our focus briefly towards the late Middle Ages, it is all too common, especially in generic Protestant circles, to think of the church, namely Rome, as foisting off on people this enormous demand for indulgences, pilgrimages, relics, works of faith, and so forth and so on, and charging for it. That this was some kind of an enormous con job run out of Rome. And to be sure, many of the humanists and most of the German princes thought it was a con job being run out of Rome. But let's remember something. You can't sell refrigerators to Eskimos. The demand was there. And we can put to one side the 40-odd tons of splinters from the cross of Christ that were floating around Europe, the 2 or 3 pints of drops of milk from the Virgin's poor breast, the relics, and all of the other stuff. And we can simply observe the fact that one of the first things that appeared from Gutenberg's brand new press was an indulgence with blank spaces in it, in which the seller could fill in the name of the purchaser, how much was paid, and how much time out of purgatory the person got. And I dare say that publishers in the late 15th and early 16th centuries were no less venal than they are now. They were in business, after all, and they did not publish things that did not sell. Indulgences were hot stuff, and so was all the rest of the stuff in this insatiable search for spiritual certainty, this hunger for assurance, this demand to be part of the Spirit. And I will add also that the church's response, and I'm using the word church in a very generic, loose sense here, I'm not pointing fingers at anybody in particular, although it's easy enough to do, that the response of those who were spokesmen for the church today is not much more effective than it was then. Erasmus, for example, who delighted in poking fun at all these things with a skill and a rapier wit that the world has scarcely seen since, save perhaps with his colleague, although they never met one another, Rabelais. Rabelais I love, because Rabelais once wrote a book to which he ascribed one of his deepest enemies' names as the author. The book bore the title Ars Petandi in Publico, I see our Latin is not quite up to snuff, which means the art of farting in public. Thank you. I thank you. Rabelais thanks you. Erasmus' habit of treating these things with scorn, laughter, irony, wit, and so forth and so on, drew a letter from his friend in the Low Countries, Martin Dorp, in which Dorp said to his friend, tears rather than laughter are the proper response to the situation we see facing us. Problem is, of course, that neither laughter nor tears do much to solve the problem, for a very simple reason. Neither meets the demand. It is, in fact, very easy to engage in cheap shots at public spirituality that evoke laughter or hand-wringing that evokes tears. I confess that I have done both and have immensely enjoyed myself in doing so. After all, somehow it puts me on a pedestal, as it were, above it all. And all the learned and some not so learned criticism, however, has done nothing to make the problem go away. It has done zero to resolve it. It has not met the demand. The demand is still there, and someone who's clever will figure out a way to meet it. Jimmy Baker, for example. Let me go on and say something about, just to illustrate the depths of this problem, that a series of articles in the Lutheran called The Way of the Spirit, I will say, by way of illustration, amount to no more than a watered-down version of the same thing that the spiritual hucksters of our time are purveying. And by the way, I said this in an ELCA church 2 weeks ago to a bunch of ELCA people, so I have no regrets about saying it to you, too. The current series of articles in the Lutheran consists of a series subtitled The Tools of the Spirit. The first three tools mentioned were silence, solitude, and the Sabbath. The next one was called Praying the Bible, and the most recent, copy that came not long before I left home, is called, in that ugliest word in the English language, journaling. I mentioned that to Bob here, and he hadn't the foggiest idea of what journaling was, and so you have before you here an example of absolute spiritual purity. Journaling, for those of you who have not encountered this beast, consists of, in the evening, writing down what happened to you during the day in spiritual terms, how you felt about things and so forth. Now, I just point out that all of these behaviors are things people do when they're alone. Okay? And they are things that people do. So I'll just leave it in one sentence. These are things people do when they are alone. And I'll just add as a footnote that in this deaconess's article where she included Sabbath among one of the things that one does, she didn't include going to church or receiving the sacrament. sometimes the things that aren't there are just as interesting as the things that are. What we have, instead of an attempt to meet the demand, is, on the one hand, the condemnation of certain individuals and certain practices from some quarters, and attempts from other quarters to domesticate these demands and the ways in which they are met. I put the Lutheran articles in the category of attempts to domesticate it, to sort of clean it up a little bit and make it respectable. And the same thing was going on in Luther's time. Now, I have to add an aside here. There is nothing wrong with seeking a little peace and quiet in life now and then. I told Professor Rosine when we were making our arrangements here that I was happy to receive anybody's hospitality, but I wanted a room alone by myself in a motel or hotel around someplace, simply so I could be alone and do what I wanted to. I find that putting my feet up tends to lower my blood pressure, and that's all to the good. I'm told also that in the transmigration to the West, the wagon trains, those trains that stopped to observe the Sabbath actually made greater, faster progress than those that went 7 days a week. There's nothing wrong with calling time out. But I want to ask this. Is a vacation, is time out, the same thing as life in the Spirit? And I'd suggest that no, it's not. Well, I have to confess also that I've got a whole list and pile of negatives here, and I promised to try to say something positive. Why do I have this big pile of negatives? Well, I suppose because it's much easier to test in anything negatively than it is to test positively. And here's where I have difficulty, and why my remarks today don't come from a written text, but from an outline, albeit a rather detailed one. I confess that I have a much better idea of what life in the Spirit is not than I do of what it is. So what follows is some more interim report, if you will, concerning the subject, and I suspect that between now and my death, I will make many more interim reports and then finally find out what it's all about. And so I hope everybody here takes my following remarks as an interim report, no matter what I may try to make of them and how much and strongly I may try to persuade you of their truth. Point number one, spirituality, or life in the Spirit, is incarnate. That is to say, it occurs in the flesh. Now this, I know, goes directly against practically everything we read or hear about spirituality. If you don't believe me on this, toddle on down to the local Christian bookstore, not your bookstore here, but the local Christian bookstore, and take a look at the how-to books, How to Be Spiritual. Nothing incarnate there. It's always time out in some respect or another. But let's have a text from Luther. Quote, "Everything our body does outwardly and physically is in reality done spiritually and must be acknowledged as such if God's word is added to it and it is done in faith. Nothing can be so material, fleshly, or external but that it becomes spiritual when it is done in the word and in faith. The spiritual is nothing other than that which is done in us and by us through the Spirit and faith. And it does not matter whether the object with which we are dealing is physical or ethereal." Now, of course, many of you know and recognize quite clearly that the context of this statement is the sacramentarian controversy over whether the bread and the wine become the body and blood of Christ in any real way. And I'm not going to bother to refight that today. But I simply point out to you that what was at stake for Luther, and if you don't believe me, read the protocols of the Marburg Colloquy. What was at stake for Luther was the incarnation. the very idea that the Word became flesh and dwelt among us. And Luther was here broadening the issues at stake in the Sacramentarian controversy, not just to Christology as an abstract theological or dogmatic issue, but to the pastoral business of whether we, as ourselves, can be spiritual. You see, what he saw in the arguments of Zwingli, Oecklampadius, Bucer, and the others was an assertion that the human body, or that the flesh, was so powerfully fleshly that it could not be penetrated by the Spirit. It could not become spiritual. And of course, the incarnation's at stake there as a dogmatic issue. There are indeed some Christological issues directly involved with that. But there's also the pastoral thing. Can I be spiritual? Can you be spiritual? We already know that our colleague, Professor Rosine, is spiritual. I would press the matter a little bit, and here I'm going to play semi-systematician, although I'm not, and don't want to be. But I think, I hope somebody took offense at that. I think there is a serious question about whether we even exist in the here and now apart from our bodies. Some of you may have heard of me because you'd encountered the Luther book or something else I'd done. That's physical. But you didn't really know I existed until you saw me in the flesh. Nor did I know any of you existed until I saw you in the flesh. I know Professor Rosine exists because I have met him many times, but he exists in my memory as that body. I know that Jonathan Bowersox exists also because he was a student of mine a couple years ago, and I remember that body. And even if I exist over the telephone, I exist physically by virtue of a series of sound waves. So too over the television, so too in the print media. Do I exist apart from my body? What, after all, is resurrected? It's not just the soul. It's the body. I hope I have a rather younger one when I'm resurrected than I do right now, but the body is resurrected. The idea of our having a soul that is distinct from our bodies is very suspicious. It was certainly suspicious to Luther. He remarked once in the Romans lectures, the early Romans lectures, "For the spirit is so deeply embedded in the flesh as to be more flesh than the flesh itself, which seeks to guard and defend it." Let me give you a perfectly ghastly and maybe even disgusting example of what Luther's saying here. I presume that there are many people in this room who are like me and that they have suffered from ingrown toenails at one time or another. This will go down henceforth as the ingrown toenail speech. I had to have them operated on 3 times, and believe me, that's painful. If you haven't had it, don't get it. Especially when they stick that Novocaine needle right in the hard part in the side of the big toe. Boy, I just send you right up the wall. But let us examine ingrown toenails for a minute, if you wish. What is their characteristic? Well, ingrown toenails, and as I can tell you from experience, grow around them what the Germans call Wildfleisch, and I think that American doctors even refer to it as Wildfleisch. It's this fleshly protuberance that grows around the ingrown toenail. What's it doing? It's growing around the point of infection. And it's, as it were, protecting that infection. What's this flesh like, this stuff? This stuff has 2 characteristics. A, it smells because it's rotting. And B, it's extraordinarily sensitive. When we go around protecting our innermost precious selves, What are we doing? Well, at the very least, we're being extraordinarily sensitive. Ourselves are more fleshly than the flesh itself, huh? Because they're the cause of the problem. So the question is, can the temporal be invaded by the eternal and remain temporal? Can that happen? And I would suggest that no form of spirituality that fails to answer this question with a resounding yes is good enough. I want to return to the earlier quotation, not the one about the spirit being deeply embedded in the flesh, but the one about nothing, the spiritual being nothing other than what is done in us and by us through the spirit and faith, and it does not matter whether the object with which we are dealing is physical or ethereal. That quotation has three characteristics that I'd like to point to. First and most obvious is the repeated reference to the Word. Where the Word is present, there we have something spiritual. Secondly, I'd simply note Luther's easy and perhaps absent-minded substitution of the word spirit for word. The third time he repeats himself on the subject. It's almost as if spirit and word are the same thing, as of course they are. And finally, I'd note that in this quotation, the verbs are in the passive voice. I read the quotation one more time. Everything our body does outwardly and physically is in reality done spiritually if God's word is added to it. Nothing can be so material, fleshly, or external but that it becomes spiritual when it is done in the word and in faith. Okay? The verbs are in the passive, not in the active. Spirituality is apparently not something we do, but something that is done to us. Now, therefore, if we are to follow Luther on the subject of life in the spirit, that life is always centered, notice I even managed to stick in a passive verb there, even though my publisher tries to beat them out of me. Our life in the spirit is always centered on Jesus. And it is something done in us and to us. Moreover, it always occurs in community. I'll go back to something I said earlier. Not me, but Luther. If this thing is done to us, then by what agency? I'm very amused that the way in which people so frequently misread the priesthood of all believers, as if to say that there are no priests. That's not what it says. It says we're all priests. How does the word get added to me? That's my question. And the answer is, you do it. I don't do it. It gets added to me by you, in a practical, behavioral sense. Or as Luther put it in Schmal called number 8, God will not deal with us except through his external word and sacrament. Anything that is attributed to the Spirit apart from word and sacrament is from the devil. Try saying that to Shirley MacLaine. Last piece, and then a summary. We have to ask this question. Let's not be afraid to ask this question, but let us boldly carry on. Are there any benefits to following Luther on the subject of life in the Spirit? Or is this just one more doctrinal cookie cutter that's slapped on the foreheads of us Lutherans so that we walk around mindless? Are there any benefits? What's the payoff? I mean, if the televangelists can ask that question and receive a large payoff, certainly we can ask that question, I would think. I think there are three
benefits.
One, we have a negative benefit. That is to say, we avoid trouble by not depending upon ourselves in any way, and in particular, not depending on ourselves for what is most important. The truth is, at least if I'm any example, we are not very dependable. We have short-term and long-term mood swings. We are not happy all the time. Some of us even suffer from depression now and then. Luther did. And one of the things we can avoid is the wrong answer to that really gut-level question. Can someone suffering from clinical depression be said to live life in the Spirit? And if the answer to that question is not yes, we are all lost, or potentially so, in the here and now. Secondly, there's a positive benefit, as this last remark might suggest, from understanding this in Luther's way, in that everyone qualifies for life in the Spirit. Everyone. Don't have to do anything. Don't have to engage in silence, solitude, Sabbath, praying the Bible, or journaling, for crying out loud. Everybody, as in the sense that Christ came for all. The third thing, second positive benefit, is that everything we do qualifies for being spiritual under the conditions prescribed when the word is added to it. And for me, this last benefit is an unutterable consolation. I'm like most everyone else in this world, in that I spend most of my life doing things that I must do. And frankly, sometimes I resent the hell out of it. Some of it I very much enjoy, but I must admit that much of it I don't. I need to be reminded that even the things that make me grit my teeth can be spiritual if the word is added to them and they are done in faith. I want to give you one example about the way I understand this mystery. I want you to imagine something. Imagine that today at noon, everybody in North America takes the rest of the day off, takes the next 24 hours off, and does nothing. Nothing. Now, obviously, that means I'm not going to get home. But bear in mind that it is entirely possible, given our affluent society, for everyone in North America to take the next 24 hours off and do nothing. Most of us have more than enough food in our refrigerators to feed ourselves during this period of time, and more than enough to feed those who don't. 24 hours doing nothing. Now ask yourself this question. How long would it take to clean up the mess that was left as a result of everybody's doing nothing for 24 hours? Most of us have more than enough food in our refrigerators to feed ourselves during this period of time, and more than enough to feed those who don't. 24 hours doing nothing. Now ask yourself this question. How long would it take to clean up the mess that was left as a result of everybody's doing nothing for 24 hours? And I don't mean just the garbage. I mean all the dead bodies from the hospitals that weren't doing anything for 24 hours. I mean the destroyed aircraft from all the air traffic controllers quitting for 24 hours. Believe me, that experience going through O'Hare Airport, you know, every time you go through there, you realize that those people are pretty important. No, you see, we're told by the world that we work for ourselves. We're told to seek our own career. We're told to make the military a great place to start. We're told to choose what we want to do, what we want to be. We're led to think that the income we receive from whatever our jobs may be is ours. We're told to make our own way in our lives. We're told to be independent individuals. Surely the most marvelously effective lie that Satan has inflicted upon our civilization. But as my illustration would suggest, the fact of the matter is that we are working for one another. That is the fact of the matter. That's reality. It's only the world in which we live that has tricked us into not seeing that reality. And it seems to me that the experience of having the word of forgiveness added to me helps me to understand that I am a servant. It frees me. As the Reformation text says from John, the truth has set me free. It frees me from self. It frees me from that ingrown toenail. It frees me to serve. Thus, truly living in the Spirit means trusting Christ and Him crucified. But of course, that's not easy. Because what happens right along with the process is that we become convinced in a deep way that we are not independent, that we are not, in any eternal sense, worth anything in and of ourselves, that we cannot become spiritual, that we have to be made spiritual, and be made spiritual by others. And so I will conclude with four litmus tests. It may grow, but four now, of what constitutes real spirituality. First of all, real spirituality and anything that is said about it always centers on the man Jesus. Second, real spirituality, real life in the Spirit, is something that happens to us. Thirdly, real life in the Spirit occurs in community. I don't mean that in any touchy-feely sense. I mean real spirituality occurs in contact with other people, other bodies. And fourthly, real spirituality changes our outlook on everything, even our jobs and the things we must do. Now let me end a final summary with one comment that I think we should also never forget. What chance is there that this view will prevail over all others? I think little. And I'm not being a pessimist about this. After all, I can end by quoting the great German physicist Max Planck, who once remarked, you can never teach your colleagues anything. The only hope for the advancement of knowledge is the certainty that they will all die.
Time, don't sit down. We have time left because you'll have to get up right away. And Professor Kittleson has agreed to answer questions. If you have some, please shoot your hand up and let's have a go at it.
How long?
10, 15 minutes.
Okay.
Robert.
Yes.
With the many books that have been written on Luther, like by Spitz and Platt, what motivated you to write this present book, Luther the Reformer?
Well, I'm not sure. it was what I call an accidental necessity. I've spent a lot of my life, of course, teaching Luther and reading Luther and so forth. And after the quincentenary of Luther's birth, as one of the survivors of that business, I gave 32 lectures out of the state of Ohio. I took myself out to lunch. And I took along a piece of paper, and I asked myself, well, Jim, what did you learn from this year? And I started jotting down things that I'd learned, and by the time I was done, I had a rough outline for a biography. And so I went back to the office, and I called the then senior editor of Augsburg Publishing House, and asked him, how many Luther biographies do you have floating around your shop as a result of the quincentenary? And he said, none. Any of you who know him, remember Rolly Siebold is a kind of sort of gruff fellow. And I said, well, how many do your colleagues in other publishing houses have floating around their shop? And he said, none. He said, in fact, I just got back from the Frankfurt Book Fair, and I was rereading Bainton's biography and thinking to myself how desperately we need to replace this thing. And so I said, well, thank you very much. And began to hang up. He said, wait a minute. Why are you asking me this? And so I answered what had happened to me at lunch that day, and he said, please send me the outline. And so we signed a contract, and I used the advance to buy a primitive word processor, and there it was. Yeah. So what motivated me? I never had any burning desire to write a Luther biography. In fact, I swore to myself that I would never write on Luther. But that was 15, 20 years ago. I suppose I swore that to myself because it was so daunting. I mean, you just go take a look at the Weimar edition of Luther's works and you... I was once quoted in the Columbus newspapers as having read all of Luther's works. Give me a break. Not true. Does that satisfy it?
Yeah. One other question. What sources did, in making all the lectures that you made, obviously you went to the Weimar edition. Were there any other sources that you used, any documents or anything that may not have been used before, or was everything pretty much standard?
You want a secret?
No, you can't tell. Nobody can tell anybody this. But I encountered one new source for this. It was put together for the quincentenary of Luther's birth. It sold like hotcakes in Germany. Obviously, Luther didn't write it. This source, and it's listed in the bibliography, by the way, this source is a chronology of Luther's life, which includes very, very brief précis of some of the main pieces that Luther wrote, including some of his correspondence. And that's where I started, for the stuff I didn't know. But the biography is basically written out of the correspondence, okay? Because I wanted to understand Luther the way he understood himself, insofar as possible. But there's no... there are no time bombs in there, I don't think. Do you? No. Now, that doesn't mean that somebody living out in the sand in Arizona doesn't like it, but that's his problem. Please, yes.
I had an opportunity to speak with Dr. Scare from Fort Wayne this past week. Mm-hmm. He had an article coming this week, Monday's edition of Christianity Today, about how the LCMS is drifting into this evangelicalism, and would you... How do you see the ELCA? Do you think that they're also running into this problem of evangelicalism or this new spirituality?
I'm surprised David would say that about you all, but then he follows what goes on in your synod more closely than I do. But as we were saying at dinner, I was saying at dinner last night and at lunch before, that is, to my mind, the chief problem that the ELCA faces. And what it is, what it amounts to my way of thinking, is this notion that I come first and that I have to be satisfied and that I can do it myself. Put it differently. We want the parousia. Everybody, you know, we want the parousia. But if it ain't going to happen cosmically, then at least it's going to happen in me, in my time, and for my sake. And I'm going to feel good about things. Well, that is pure, raw, unadulterated selfishness. And it also has the effect in congregations, this I know from experience, it has the effect of dividing congregations between those folks who are spiritual and those folks who aren't. You know, after the 15th time you've been invited to the conference on the Holy Spirit and you refuse to go, people begin to conclude that you're not spiritual. All right? So I think it's a... I know it's a terrible problem within the ELCA, and I also know that it is one that not many people want to talk about, you know, because it gets too close to home. And what I'm trying to suggest today is that if we can talk about it in something other than merely condemnatory ways, if we can talk about it in a positive way, what is spirituality? Not what isn't it, but what is it? How does it happen? And frankly admit the fact that we are going to remain human beings. Then there's a chance to save the remnant. But it's always the remnant. We have to confess that. It will always be the remnant. Read the LCMS's statement on the evangelism and the church growth movement. It's a very nicely done piece. But that's triumphalism of one kind or another, too. Others, please feel free. This is where I learn something. You have a duty to me, too. Teach me something. Yes?
It seems, maybe not so much recently, but at other times, it seems that anything could be put into the mouth of Luther by people, you know, who've got their own agenda, can be made out to be charismatic, or, you know, people will go to anyone. Why, how can they, I mean, what's the material? How can they get that stuff? Do they just look for obscure quotes, or is there...
Well, it's selective quotation and downright intentional misunderstanding. I mean, just a beauty I read 2 years ago. Oh, this is from the Baptist General Convention. Now, like Martin Luther, we say that no one stands between us and God. Everyone comes to God by themselves. This is the meaning of the priesthood of all believers. What one of my friends down in Ohio refers to as Horsgeschichte. For the simple reason that the priesthood of all believers does not mean that there are no priests, right? It means that we're all priests. And that, you know, how do I get the grace of God? You mediate it to me. Correct? And so I just think it's blindness, it's willful misreading. And I suspect that any Luther scholar could reply the same way. My favorite is the reappearing ecumenical Luther, but then I've already had my say about that. Others? Yes?
Yeah, I agree all you said, saying, but the point is, you seem to single out the individual devotion practice, something like that. For example, you said the real spirituality is happen to us or occur in the community. See, how you balance, you know, to the people, they are lay people, they listen to you saying that everything we do is spiritual.
If the word is
there. If the word is there. So they will how you balance, you know, you also need your spiritual individual practice. You know what I mean?
Oh, I know what you mean. I was raised in a pietist family, where such things were highly regarded, and I've been spending my life outgrowing that. to greater or lesser success. but I will stick with what I said there. And I here we come to the interim report character of what I said, but when I take time out to meditate, just to vegetate, to reflect on my life and what I'm doing, if I'm honest with myself, the picture that will result from this process is a pretty bleak one. Now, how do I get out of that? And presumably I'm supposed to be honest with myself, correct? How do I get out of the depression that would normally follow this kind of bleak picture? I can't get out of it myself. I just can't do it. And that means that I have to be in community with somebody else. And commonly, just to be honest with myself, I have to be talking with somebody else who will make me be honest with myself, who will hold up that mirror to me in which I see myself. I know this is a bad exegesis of the passage, but where did Jesus say he would be present? Where two or three are gathered, right? In my name. Yes?
I think that the American individuals you talked about has gone back across into Europe, numbers like myself, and you see it coming back here again for the things that are crossing over. But it seems that all too often we read Christ talk about one body, and even more so the church is his bride. Christ never set himself up as a bigamist. And while that body is composed of many members, and those members care for other members of the body, there is still only one bride, the church that Christ loves and cares for. And we're called into that church by our baptism. And we're joined together by the Holy Spirit with one another. And if we divorce ourselves from that, then we have excommunicated ourselves. But all the terminology speaks corporately. Even when we're alone, it's our Father, because it was our Lord and Savior Jesus who gave us the right to pray.
Exactly. I would say that even when I'm alone, I'm not really alone, because I have the memories and the impressions and the feelings of all the people in me. I mean, I can't escape them. And so even though I'm technically alone, I'm not lonely. And I'm part of this body of the faithful. I couldn't agree with you more. Yes.
I find great strength, gain great strength at times when I'm alone with the Lord and His Word. And you being a Luther scholar would know much better than I, but it seems to me that Luther himself spent many hours, 2 hours daily, in fact, I think he commented, just in order that he might be able to fight against Satan and all that he was throwing at him to accomplish the work that Luther had to do. So there again, he was gaining strength in his time alone with the Lord in prayer and His Word.
Well, I guess I would reply to that there are a lot of times when I end up being refreshed from being alone. And there are many times that that prayer is part of that being alone. Okay? And I certainly don't mean to say anything negatively about prayer. That's not my intent at all, to the extent that one is alone and one's praying. But I would say that it is very easy for me to confuse the sort of psychic and physical re-nourishing that occurs from being alone for a time. Very easy for me to confuse that as a natural bodily process, with real spirituality. And then what's the conclusion of that confusing? The conclusion of that confusing is, if I get myself all alone, then I will become spiritual, and suddenly I'm doing it. And who's the focus on? The focus is on me. Now, that's why Luther had grave doubts, and most of the reformers with him, had grave doubts about private Bible reading. Grave doubts as to whether that was a good idea at all. You run through Luther's works, and he always talks about that kind of thing, and the catechism and so forth as occurring most commonly in the family. That is to say, not alone. So, I think I dissent. But then I've got the microphone, so. Anybody else?
I hate to end on a note of dissent, but we have run to the end of our time. You've given us something we can all go home and write about in our journals this evening. We appreciate your having come today, and if there are more of you who wish to say a word or two, you are certainly welcome to stay. Thanks for coming.